You're on 3CR Breakfast with Annie, and as I said, I had a chat with Ian McIntyre about his fantastic new book, Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, Radical Science Fiction, 1950 to 1985, which is being put up for Best Related Work in the new the Hugo Awards. Quite fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, Radical Science Fiction, 1950 to 1985. This is a section of history that you and your co-editor, Andrew Nett, are quite in love with, aren't you?
Yeah, look, this is a period that we've been quite interested in. This is the third book that we've done on it. The first was called Girl Gangs, Biker Boys and Real Cool Cats. And that kind of looked at the, I guess, pulp and paperback fiction to do with youth subcultures. And then we did a second book called Sticking It to the Man, and that again focused on kind of pulp, paperback, mainstream genre fiction, which dealt with the radical politics kind of the 60s and 70s, but kind of went back to the 50s to look at the precedents and antecedent and early writings, and then went up to kind of 1980 to see how things developed. And basically that second book was going to include some chapters about science fiction, but the book just kept growing and growing, and eventually the publisher said enough. So we decided really that science fiction deserved a book of its own. But yeah, so we've done sort of, yeah, these three books now looking at kind of post-war paperbacks and yeah, different aspects of kind of counterculture, youth culture and radical culture.
And the reason for why you're doing this, and the reason for why you're now honed in on science fiction, is because this particular time of history was extremely important in changing or expressing in popular culture what was going on economically and politically and socially.
Popular culture always kind of reflects the wider culture, sometimes leads it, sometimes is kind of behind it. And I should mention, we've also covered, I guess, unpopular culture in that the more sort of marginal works and experimental works that kind of led the way. So, yeah, as many people would be aware, the sort of long 60s, that kind of period from the 60s through to the 70s, was a period of quite marked sort of social upheaval and challenges to the established order. And this flowed through in, you know, all sorts of ways, but in one way was in the kind of fiction of the time. I guess in terms of the sort of radicalism, on the one hand, you had authors who were trying to reflect on the times. You also had, in terms of genre fiction, a lot of hacks, really, looking for topics to exploit. So, you know, they were writing about different radical movements or whatever, often in quite sort of conservative or right-wing ways. And then you also had people who were members of the movements of the time. And because publishers realised that there were audiences for this stuff, a lot of people who had previously had to hide their politics or compromise their politics or simply just hadn't had opportunities to be published now got those chances. In doing so, they sort of got to push the boundaries of science fiction and fiction overall. So for some people, I guess their radicalism was kind of seen in expression, style and aesthetics, you know, so that's the sort of influences of the Beats and modernism and new journalism, psychedelics, non-Christian spirituality, all that kind of had an impact on both the writing but also book covers. And then, as I said, you know, you had authors who were part of or were influenced by sort of left-wing anti-authoritarian and liberation movements, and so they got to write about, you know, from the perspective of the movements they're involved in and kind of imagine new futures, produce new takes on classic sci-fi tropes. So, yeah, you had all these works mainly from the mid to late 60s onwards, which challenged conservative literary sexual politics and other conventions. So you've got these sort of thought-provoking, experimental and kind of politicised works. And eventually there were enough of them that they came to be dubbed the new wave of science fiction. Some authors didn't really like to be pigeonholed in that way, thinking of J.G. Ballard particularly. But, you know, the new wave sort of arrived. It created a lot of controversy within science fiction, but it basically changed the genre forever.
Yeah, and it changed the world too, actually, because now that we're in this period of history, much of the stuff that were contentious then are actually the foundations of what people take for granted today, in form as well as in subject.
Yeah, and totally, and things that we're defending today, yeah.
I know that the title of your book, Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, are actually referring to two very important, well, one was an anthology and one was a, well, what was it? It was a magazine, was it, New Worlds?
Yeah, so, yeah, we sort of, other than making for a snappy title, it was sort of a way to pay tribute, really, to those two sets of work. So Dangerous Visions was an anthology put together by science fiction writer and raconteur Harlan Ellison, which collected together, you know, a whole bunch of different people who were kind of pushing the boundaries, in, you know, politically and socially and morally in other ways within science fiction in the 60s. So he put that together, and then there was a follow-up called Again, Dangerous Visions. And yeah, this was kind of a showcase of a lot of the key writers of the period, and I guess sort of marked really the kind of arrival of these writers. So yeah, that was one of the key rights books. But there were a number of anthologies at the time. There was sort of a shift. I mean, there were still a lot of science fiction magazines publishing short stories and so forth, but there was kind of a shift more and more to the paperback anthology. And so Judith Merrill's England Swings, and there are a number of other anthologies at the time that kind of were quite groundbreaking, and it became quite a popular sort of form of publishing short stories. So Dangerous Visions from Harlan Ellison had a big impact. Equally, if not more so, New Worlds magazine, which was a British publication which had been around for some decades, but Michael Moorcock, again another science fiction writer, he took over editing it in the 60s and basically published from both the US and the UK, you know, a number of groundbreaking stories. And he kind of broadened the magazine away from just being about science fiction. So it kind of took up a number of aesthetic and political issues of the time, and included sort of experimental poetry and other stuff. So that magazine then sort of became an anthology series itself. Yeah, it was kind of where a lot of people like John Bruner and J.G. Ballard, Moorcock himself and others sort of got their opportunity to get their more experimental and more radical works first published.
The ability to be able to alter the minds of readers through popular culture and create controversy, I suppose, was ripe for that period of history. I know that one of the strings to the fight was that the decision to call themselves speculative fiction rather than science fiction as a way of separating themselves from the earlier preoccupations.
Yeah, I mean, some of the writers who were, I guess, part of the new wave were quite happy with the sci-fi thing. Others, yeah, they wanted to sort of mark this line where they, you know, they were kind of different to what they saw as sort of prim and proper fiction of the 50s that was quite conservative and, you know, just had male, kind of straight white male heroes who were off conquering planets, you know, and had that whole kind of imperial sort of feel. So the fact that a lot of this work, I guess, was about inner space as much as outer space. A lot of it was about kind of near future utopias and dystopias, you know, set on Earth, kind of moved away from the session or idea of, you know, capitalist and technological progress as, you know, being intertwined and inevitable. So these people, you know, had critiques of capitalism, of, you know, technology wasn't necessarily going to make, you know, be the solution to everything and automatically go in a positive direction and so forth. This 60s science fiction, like many aspects of kind of 60s radicalism, was a pushback against the conservatism of earlier periods. And so, yeah, that speculative idea, I guess, meant that people were trying to say, well, we don't have to just have these classic kind of science fictional type tropes and ideas. At the same time, you had a lot of science fiction that worked with things like, you know, your classic astronauts and so forth, except for in this case, you know, the astronauts were just as likely to be kind of bored corporate minions or kind of cracking under the pressure of kind of military rule or you know, as in the Forever War, kind of stuck in these interminable Vietnam-like battles, which, you know, science fiction, yeah, you know, wars of the future that kind of dehumanized them. And so, you know, you had people playing around with it. I mean, one of the books that really influenced me when I first started reading sci-fi as, I guess, sort of late primary school, early teens, was Ursula Le Guin's Word for the World is Forest, which is basically about a colonization, you know. So rather than, yeah, the all-conquering noble heroes, you know, it was sort of more from the perspective of the people who were being conquered and how they adapted and dealt with this invasion. And, you know, as a young person, you know, I was aware of, because of my family upbringing and the other kids I went to school with and stuff, I was kind of aware of you know, the effects of colonisation and you know, in Australia. But that book really kind of got me inside, you know, to really think about it through a setting that was, you know, that was in outer space.
Yeah, yeah, she has a fantastic... There's so many of her stories that are so fantastic. One of them... the idea of gender roles in particular, she plays around with in a fantastic way. And also the other women writers who, in fact, some of them taking male names and people believing that they must be, Alice Sheldon, for example, using James Tiptree Jr. I've read things about her where people have said, oh, it must be a male writer because women couldn't possibly write those kind of stories. I think that's hilarious.
Yes, and I guess that was sort of a hangover in some ways from the 50s for them. And we have a chapter in the book about them. Initially, even amongst the more radical writers in the 60s, it was very male-dominated, but then as the 60s went on, you know, in keeping with kind of second-wave feminism in general, more and more female writers got published and got recognised and similarly challenged wider conventions, but also challenged those kind of conventions within science fiction itself, because science fiction's always particularly had this really healthy kind of fan culture. One of the challenges with doing this book was living up to, you know, or trying to live up to all that kind of history of debate and analysis of these kind of works which already existed. So, you know, with our first two books, really with the sort of fiction about youth subcultures, there hadn't been much done outside of academic works that looked at those books. And to an extent with our second book, Sticking It to the Man, quite a few of the radical books in the kind of crime, adventure, thriller, romance and other kind of genres, they too hadn't really been written about as much, but this was a field that had been.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a little bit of a challenge to think about how could we put a book together that would give a collection. So there's a number of contributors that we've got to the book that would give people who are new to this a sense of what was the breadth and the depth of the works that were going on, but also would cover those key writers, but would also offer something for people who are, you know, more longer term fans.
You're on 3CR Breakfast with Annie, and we're having a chat with Ian McIntyre about his new work, Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, Radical Science Fiction, 1950 to 1985, put together with Andrew Nett. They've been put forward for a Hugo Award for Best Related Work, and we'll just finish up the chat.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because over time I've read quite a few of the various people that you talk about, like the different writers. And each time I've read their books, there's been a sort of a frisson of excitement at the clarity that they're presenting. Or even most of the stories are confronting or lead you down a rabbit hole. And it's also, like you say, people like Philip K. Dick, for example, makes an art form out of placing the protagonists into the ordinary world, like they're ordinary people, they're everyday Joes, you know what I mean, as a general rule. And this is political in itself. I mean, if you go back to C.S. Lewis is the one about the man who goes to the moon. I can't remember what it's called. I'm bad with names. But it's so esoteric and unfeeling in its presentation that I was surprised that it had been so shocking to people at the time that it was written. That's part of the old guard, right? And then if you read some of the stuff that comes out of Michael Moorcock, that they are rollicking yarns. And having learned a little bit about him, he's a working class. He came from a working class rackety inner London kind of family. And it comes out in the iconoclastic nature of his language. It's quite fantastic. So it's quite clear that this genre gave people the opportunity to express a really lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, Moorcock's interesting because he was very much in the heart of the UK counterculture. So not only was he sort of doing New Worlds, but he was also sort of hanging out with bands like Hawkwind and, you know, the sort of playing a space rock band. And, you know, he was part of that. That kind of 60s radical counterculture. You know, there was this kind of split, of course, you know, again, between, I guess, you know, what was roughly called the old guard and the new wave. And that was really kind of exemplified in 1968. This magazine, Galaxy Science Fiction, carried two advertisements. One had a list of authors who were, you know, opposed to the Vietnam War, and the other had a list who were in favour. And sort of the people who put the list together, you know, included Judith Merrill and Kate Wilhelm, both of whom had been around for a while politically and as authors, but, you know, their work sort of got new, you know, so they were sort of leaders within the kind of new wave. And they had sort of thought, well, science fiction writers, they're thinking about the future, they're mainly going to be kind of progressive to some degree. And then they were sort of like, whoa, okay. So, you know, they found that a number of people refused to sign it, and indeed sort of had this ad, you know, that really exemplified, I guess, that split. And that was a generational split that was going on for a lot of people. But of course, people sometimes focus a bit too much on the generational split of the era. So somebody like Judith Merrill had been around since the 40s, you know, so they weren't like, you know, a baby boomer, you know, yeah, they weren't sort of young, you know, this kind of left-wing current went back for some time. It was just now the opportunities were there more in, as I say, in the 60s and 70s for a whole range of people to be who they were. And obviously, you know, the struggle around that continues, clearly. But this was a period when things began to open up. And some people, quite experimental and radical works, were achieving massive sales, like Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren, I think, sold 500,000 copies or something, you know, made the bestsellers. So, you know, that's the major impact.
And of course, we must recognise that these things wouldn't happen if the capitalist system didn't decide that they were consumable items.
But yeah, I mean, it took, I guess, you know, with like most things, sort of people on the fringes to push stuff. So, you know, Moorcock and new worlds, you know, sort of publishing this stuff.
That, yeah, taking the risk.
Kind of moving in and realising, oh, okay, there's a market here, and yes, we'll have to bend or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were entrepreneurial as well as fantastic writers, as it were. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that people should realise coming out of this array of books that you put forward. Things like the issues around ecology are not new. People have been writing about human interaction with the environment for decades. So it's not a news story, but also the obsession that Hollywood has with dystopia comes from this period, and also the interesting speculation on the ennui, and I don't know what this word means, anomie.
Oh, anime. So, anime. Yeah, I mean, the kind of sense of, I guess, meaninglessness.
Yeah, it's a great word.
Yeah.
And you also, the way you write it in your introduction, of technologically drenched modern life. Technologically drenched modern life. Fantastic.
Yeah, which of course, you know, has only become more so.
That's
so
right.
In this period, you know, people were kind of mainly...
they were just babies.
I guess kind of riffing on television and so forth, and the impact of television, you know, without, yeah, to the point where we are now. And of course, on the ecology, I mean, a lot of these themes, again, had a long pedigree, you know, going back to the late 19th century, earliest 20th century, you know, with Frankenstein and Edward Bellamy and, you know, and then later on sort of Aldous Huxley and George Orwell and so forth, you know, looking at utopias and dystopias, Catherine Perkins Gilmore's another one, you know, all to do with sort of feminism, ecology, authoritarianism, but, you know, with Huxley, you know, sort of how society could be, you know, manipulated through... I guess kind of pleasure and hedonism, but again, yes, you have again in the 60s and 70s this kind of critical mass of loads of people writing about these things, and of course with the ecological stuff, you know, in keeping with the whole movement in the early 70s, you know, the blossoming of that movement, there was the kind of, on the one hand, you had some critical books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, but on the other hand, it was just as today we're going through a period, it was obvious the effects of, you know, of planetary exploitation. So then it was more in terms of things like pollution and acid rain and that kind of thing. It's, you know, it was in people's face. Now it's bushfires and floods.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You know, and, yeah. Another one of my favourite novels from this period, and one that sort of influenced my outlook, is John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up, which...
Great title.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean... It's a whole series of vignettes which basically bring home, I suppose, the nature of ecological collapse in terms of it, you know, being this sort of series of cascading changes and catastrophes rather than this sort of single big bang classic kind of apocalyptic moment that instead it's, you know, it's something that kind of
keeps
there
up on
to
you.
See, but it's all, but it also creeps up on you. And, you know, that novel in some ways, you know, being from the early 70s, it's got a number of things in it that are very much kind of period pieces, I suppose, you know. But on another level, its treatment of things like the organic food industry, the kind of industries that grow up around coping with ecological damage. Yeah, I just think it's a really brilliant novel that just doesn't leave you necessarily with a great feeling of hope at the at the end. And I guess that's something that, you know, when you were talking about the fact that dystopia has become so all pervasive as a genre and so popular, and that a lot of the kind of dystopian themes that we still see today kind of grew out of this period. So, you know, around ecological collapse, around nuclear war, you know, kind of social collapse and so forth.
Probably one of the most interesting elements about the favourite Hollywood trope about dystopia is that they overlay it with cowboys and Indians.
Yes, there's a lot of very Western style, as in the Western as the genre, yeah, for sure. So one of the things that sort of looking at this stuff I considered was that, you know, kind of dystopia, I think a lot of its ability to shock has kind of worn off. I think probably in the 60s and 70s, dystopia is kind of as warning and as a way of kind of trying to shock people into action was probably more effective than it is now. You know, in some ways, a lot of the dystopias have almost become kind of like cozies, you know, and in other ways, you know, they can easily kind of reinforce this idea that doom and collapse is inevitable. Kind of reinforces that idea of capitalist realism or whatever, you know, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, and often reinforces that kind of dog-eat-dog kind of capitalist relations after disasters, when in fact, you know, often during disasters, people come together in the most amazing ways to kind of support each other, you know, collectively.
Well, you see, the thing about your book is that it's really fascinating that someone should take seriously and do proper work around discussing popular culture that's been so transformative. This whole area of fiction and popular culture in general has a huge effect on the mind state of the people in general. It's a great thing. And in fact, your book's been nominated for a Hugo Award, which is just gobsmacking.
Yeah, look, Andrew Netty, my co-editor and myself, yeah, we're pretty...
The Australian word would be stoked.
Yeah, I was going to say stoked. Yeah, look, we were very, very pleased to see that it's been nominated for a Hugo. So, yeah, we're sort of the Chi-Con is the big science fiction convention where they kind of announce the winners of the Hugos in September. But, you know, regardless of whether it wins or not, it's you know, extremely gratifying and humbling. And, you know, we've got about 20 contributors to this. So I think it's a real, you know, hopefully a testament to all the work that they did as well.